Hi everyone, my name's Sir Andrew Robertson. I'm a senior associate at Pinsent Masons in the insolvency team, and I specialise, amongst other things, on construction insolvency issues with a particular focus on the supply chain. Alongside me today, I've got Marcus Birch, who's an associate director in the construction team at Brian Cave Leighton Paisner. Thanks for joining us. Today's webinar is going to be looking at construction insolvency issues, and we're going to be touching on a number of key areas that we think will be relevant to you, either in advising your clients who may be seeing more of these issues come across their desks in recent months because of the impact of the pandemic and the continued distress in the sector generally, or you may be an in-house lawyer who's being asked to advise your business on a number of these issues as they come up. We're going to focus today's session on looking at some of the key insolvency events that exist under UK law, and I'll take you through some of those. We'll look at some of the early warning signs that can be helpful and assist you or your clients in making sure that you're better prepared for dealing with insolvency as and when those issues arise. We'll look at some of the key rights under some of the standard form contracts in relation to insolvency. We'll touch upon some of the recent case law around the interplay between adjudication and insolvency on construction contracts. And then we'll also look at some of the main issues in relation to retention of title, which can be another area that comes up quite frequently in insolvency scenarios. So moving on to the next slide, insolvency basics. There is a table on slide number four, which sets out there the main insolvency procedures that exist under UK law. Now, if you're not used to dealing with insolvency situations, you can often look at these and think that they all blur into one, and not be very clear on what the distinctions are between them. There are some quite important distinctions between these processes. And I think one of the key fundamentals when you're looking at insolvency generally is to understand exactly what has gone on in relation to your contractual counterparty or your client's contractual counterparty, so that you can properly and accurately advise both what the rights are as a result of that under your contract or elsewhere, but also what it means in terms of dealing with an insolvency practitioner or continuing to deal with the insolvent company. And that will vary depending on which process you've come up against. So we're just going to look at some of these on a high level now, and I'll take you through some of the distinctions. The first one there at the top of the list is a CVA or a company voluntary arrangement. Now, because it's called a voluntary arrangement, that means it's not actually a formal insolvency process, contrast to liquidation and administration, which are listed underneath. It is an informal process where the company essentially proposes a compromise with its creditors outside of a formal insolvency process, where the company will work with an insolvency practitioner who is called the nominee or the supervisor of the CVA to propose a compromise to creditors or certain categories of creditors, essentially saying that we are in financial distress. We would like to put this proposal forward to agree a compromise with our creditors. And the alternative, if this isn't agreed, is that we'll end up going into an administration or liquidation process. And as a result of that, creditors would get less than we are proposing in the voluntary arrangement. And therefore, you, as our creditor base, should vote for it. Now, for a CVA to be successfully implemented, the company needs to obtain the consent of 75% of its unsecured creditors, so trade creditors and the like, who vote for it. It's fair to say that CVAs are not that commonly used in the construction sector. We have seen one or two over the years, but it's more likely, certainly in the current climate, that CVAs are being used in other sectors such as retail, casual dining, hospitality, and leisure. So it may not be that prevalent, but it is possible that a company in the construction sector can use a CVA to compromise their liabilities. Contrast that with liquidation and administration, which are much more common in the construction sector. It remains a steady fact, unfortunately, for the sector that construction and infrastructure as a sector remains top of the charts when it comes to the numbers of formal insolvency cases in the UK. And that's been the case now for at least the last two to three years. Liquidation is essentially a process where a company's life comes to an end. It is a final and formal insolvency process where either the company gets wound up by the court as a result of a winding up petition being presented against it for an undisputed debt, or because the directors themselves have resolved to place the company into liquidation. The important thing to remember from your perspective, if you're dealing with a company that goes into liquidation, is that essentially at that point in time, it ceases to trade. And the idea of the liquidation process is that it will then be broken up and its assets will be dealt with by an insolvency practitioner for the benefit of creditors, and anything that's available to be realised for creditors will then be shared amongst them. But often that is very little, unfortunately, for the creditor base. An administration process is also a formal process where the company enters into administration and an insolvency practitioner is appointed over its affairs and an administrator. It is not necessarily a fully terminal and final process in the same way that liquidation is. It is meant to be a more flexible process where the administrator has a number of options that it can use to its benefit to achieve the purpose of the administration. And that purpose is often to achieve a better result than would be the case if the company had gone into a liquidation process. So what does that mean? Essentially, that means an administrator can continue to trade the business. They can look to sell assets off. They can hold the business for a period of time. And they can also enter into what's called a pre-pack or a pre-packaged sale, which some of you may be aware of. It's essentially a sale of the business and assets, which is negotiated and agreed behind the scenes prior to the administrator's appointment taking effect. And then as soon as they're appointed, the sale completes and the business continues. And in the construction sector, we've seen a fair bit of use of pre-pack transactions, particularly at certain levels of the market, back to connected parties, so back to directors and shareholders of businesses. And it's come under some scrutiny for a while. That particular process, the pre-pack process, has been criticised as being something which is not particularly transparent, doesn't necessarily result in best returns for creditors, and actually is something that the government is now legislating on. So there are some new regulations coming out next year. At the moment, we're expecting them in May, that will seek to regulate and make it more difficult for those types of pre-pack sales back to connected parties to be completed. So you need to watch out for that as we come into next year. Just briefly, before I move on, we have two new insolvency processes which are available to companies now. And that's as a result of some new legislation that came into force in June, the Corporate Insolvency and Governance Act 2020. The restructuring plan listed there, I won't touch upon, because that is something that's designed to deal with much larger companies that have considerable financial debt within them, so lots of secured debt or other categories of secured creditor. It's unlikely that construction businesses will use a restructuring plan unless they're at the very, very top of the market. The moratorium is something that we may see greater use of, particularly as we go into next year, when the existing government support that's in place to protect businesses against winding up petitions and the like starts to fall away. That moratorium is a new process, completely new process, and essentially it allows the directors of a company outside of an insolvency process to file a piece of paper at court to obtain immediately a moratorium against creditor action. So that includes winding up petitions or legal proceedings being commenced or continued against that company, initially for a period of 20 business days, although it can quite easily be extended for another 20 business days. Now, the directors within that moratorium, they have to make a statement that they believe the company can be rescued as a going concern. So the idea is that it will be used as a precursor to some wider restructuring to try and save the business. But it remains to be seen how widely that moratorium is used by directors, and also whether we see it being used tactically to avoid potential summary judgment type applications or adjudications, etc., if they're coming up and the directors of one of the parties is distressed and wants to try and avoid it or delay it. And that is that's a tool that's available now. So you need to be aware of that coming down the line. So moving on to the next slide, Marcus is just going to take us through some of the standard forms of contract and how they deal with insolvency.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. It's just important, having understood what the main insolvency processes are, how insolvency is addressed in the main standard forms. And so what we've done there on the slide is we pulled out the definitions in the two main forms that are used in this country. We've taken it as an example on the JCT suite, the design and build contract, and in clause 8.1 there, that says the company becomes insolvent when it enters administration, administrative receivership, or it passes a resolution for voluntary winding up, or indeed a winding up order is made. And there's also a wider catch-all provision in 8.1 that covers the circumstances when a company enters into any sort of arrangement or compromise with its creditors. And there's a similar pattern in clause 91.1 of the NEC suite. The definition there covers those insolvency processes, and there's a catch-all provision for some sort of arrangement with creditors. And what's important to remember there is that when we're talking about insolvency in the main standard forms, it's not a substantive definition. We're not talking about inability to pay debts or any other balance sheet insolvency or whatever. We're talking about entry into those processes. So there's a very clear line as to when a party is insolvent from a construction contract point of view. Now, Andy mentioned the two new forms of insolvency process under the SEGA. Apparently, there are no plans either at JCT or NEC to amend the standard forms in order to cover those. If you look, the Part 26A restructuring plan is probably covered by those catch-all provisions I talked about, but it's very difficult to fit the new moratorium process in into that wording. So we would recommend bespoke wording in future in your JCT or NEC contracts to cover any circumstance where a party, your contractual counterparty, enters into that process, just so that it's covered and there's no dispute about that. So those are the definitions of insolvency, and we're going to identify the effects of insolvency under the standard forms later in the talk. But first, Andy, why don't you talk about sort of early warning signs of insolvency?
Yeah, thanks, Marcus. So if we move on to the next section, so early warning signs, I think it's worth spending some time on this before we get into what actually happens when a company becomes insolvent, because this can be absolutely invaluable to you and your clients if you can take certain steps to prepare yourselves or your client's business for insolvency. And if you can get some procedures in place to understand exactly what the position is, what's coming down the line and what your rights are, then when the worst does happen and things move very quickly in those circumstances, you will be best placed to deal with those issues as they arise, rather than sort of scrambling around at that point in time, trying to make sense of it all, and not really knowing how to react. So the first sign there, pre-insolvency, early warning. There are a number of things that you, your business or your client's business can do to understand the status of a contractual counterparty, whether that's your employer or your contractor or key subcontractors or suppliers. And they range from legal searches that can be undertaken to standard sort of credit searches and credit checks that can be undertaken. And the point of this is both to build a picture of the financial health and status of a particular counterparty, but also, you know, as is often the case in the construction sector, if there are rumours flying around that this company or that company has become insolvent, the important thing to do is to cut through all that and try and find out exactly what has happened, rather than relying on the rumour mill. So the legal warning signs are, I think the most important one is understanding that you can search what's called the central index, so that the company's courts, both in London and in the regional courts, has what's called a central index, where you can ring them up, give them the name of a company, and they will provide you with up-to-date information as to whether there is any outstanding insolvency proceedings filed in relation to that company. So that will capture winding up petitions, it will capture any documents filed in relation to the appointment of administrators. It will also capture filings in relation to the new moratorium process that's come into force, as well as court documents in relation to the restructuring plan and also CVAs that I touched upon. So fundamentally, from an accuracy point of view, that is the best way to find out exactly what is happening and what the status is in relation to the insolvency of a particular counterparty that you're interested in. More widely, you can do searches for county court judgments, and your clients or your business's credit teams will also have software that they will use to check the credit health and credit status of counterparties. And I would always encourage that both of those, that sort of financial health assessment and the legal assessment, is used hand in hand, because that will give you the best indication of the health status and insolvency status of a counterparty. Now, alongside that, I think there are a number of things you can do, either as a private practice lawyer or as an in-house lawyer, to prepare yourselves for what happens if the insolvency is confirmed. And the first of those is always to go back to what the contractual position is, making sure that you've got the relevant contracts to hand. Are they signed? You know, what do they say in relation to insolvency and rights upon insolvency? And also, in connection with that, what's the position more broadly on the project? Do you have payment or performance security in place that might assist where there is an insolvency? Is there payment protection or other insurance out there that can come to your aid, both in terms of the ability to complete the project if your counterparty becomes insolvent, and also to help mitigate and compensate for damages which may be incurred as a result of that insolvency? And if we move on to the next slide, I think the other area that people often overlook is the status and importance of intellectual property and other rights that may be required to complete a particular project or works. You know, if there is valuable intellectual property, where is it held? If there are drawings, for example, you know, do you have copies of those if the originals are held by the other party? Are there valuable databases or other programming that's needed from a technology point of view to complete the project? And also understanding what the payment position is. So both in terms of the payment position under your contract with that counterparty, are there outstanding payment applications coming down the line, or is there deadlines coming down the line for service of withholding notices and the like? And if you're the employing party or you're higher up in the supply chain and the insolvency looks like it's going to occur at contractor level, are there key suppliers or subcontractors down below that need to be given consideration? And what is their likely position in terms of outstanding payments? And I think tying all that together, it is really a focusing on what the business is, your business or your client's business, what their objectives would be if they're in relation to this impending insolvency. Now, this is always a bit of a debate, depending on the status of the works, the status of the project, and also the importance of the counterparty that you are dealing with. So if it's a contractor or a supplier that's going bust, the objectives will be very different depending on the importance of that party. If they're just a run-of-the-mill contractor or subcontractor that can be easily replaced, then chances are the objectives of the business may well be to protect your position, terminate and move on. However, if they are business critical, they're providing some bespoke services, it's going to be very difficult or very expensive to find someone else to step in and perform those services, then fundamentally the objectives of the business will be very different. And it may be that you need to find ways to try and ensure a continuity of supply rather than terminating and walking away. So I think I'd always advise if you come up against impending insolvency, if you try and piece together a number of those factors that I've just talked through, that will stand you or your clients in the best stead when the actual insolvency occurs, and will enable you to move very quickly in those circumstances. And on the next slide, which is the one I'm most proud of in terms of its diagrammatic formation, we've sought to summarize a lot of those points and bring them together in the context of, okay, the insolvency has now actually occurred. Often this causes a bit of panic within your business or your client's business because people don't necessarily understand what's gone on or what they should do about it. Things do change once insolvency has occurred. You need to move very quickly. You're often dealing with an insolvency practitioner rather than the people that you have been dealing with before. So we've tried to put together the fundamentals on that slide, coupled with the pre-planning that hopefully you've been through, so that, again, you're best placed to deal with the insolvency in those circumstances. And Marcus, I don't know if you have anything to add from what I've just been talking about, what you would advise clients to do in those circumstances.
Well, that's right. It's a combination of two things, I think, as we've demonstrated on the slide. It's a matter of looking at the project, securing your key contracts, your key people, your key equipment, and on the one hand, carrying on with the job. But on the other side, there has to be some sort of back office team looking at the contracts and looking at potential claims. Because, you know, when the music stops, as they say, and somebody becomes insolvent, there will be claims, there will be losses somewhere. So there needs to be an emphasis played on both sides. And I think that's what we've tried to describe there, is that each category there on the slide has its own work streams associated, some more urgent than others. And we'll look at payment and we'll look at termination later on. But they're really, those are for one sort of round of concerns. However, what you really want on a big construction project is to make sure that the project continues. And so that's why it's the emphasis on key contracts, key equipment, and key people. That needs to be the immediate priority in most projects.
Yeah, and I think, you know, not overlooking things like practical steps, making sure that sites are secured, goods are secured, checking the insurance position, etc. On day one, that's also very, very important to make sure that you know, value doesn't start to evaporate immediately, and those simple steps that you can take or your business can take to protect the project or the site, those are also very important.
Yeah. So, I mean, what we had decided to talk about first, and it's probably a little bit extreme, that where we wanted to go next with the talk was your options on insolvency. And in a sense, we've summarized that at the moment into two big options of things we wanted to talk about. There's a whole world of things that you need to do, but we wanted to focus on two things. The first one, which we cover here in slide 11, is termination. Now, that should, of course, be a last resort, but it's often good to know what your last resort is, even if you don't necessarily take that step straight away. So on that slide, we identify the importance of rights to terminate, and we talk about when you can terminate. Now, as we say on the slide, the important thing really is to identify first, before anything, that you actually have an express right in your contract to terminate for insolvency. And it was held in that Perart case in 1994 that insolvency in itself is not a ground for termination. So there needs to be an express clause there, and you may be surprised if it isn't there. Now, usually it's not a problem, because in all the standard forms that we use, there's an express right to terminate in the event of insolvency. We've listed them on the slide there. Under the JCT, it's 8.5 and 8.10, depending on which party you are. And under NEC4, it's clause 91.1. But you know, what's important to remember there is, of course, that this is insolvency in the definition that we saw before of entry into a formal insolvency process. So it's not enough for there to be rumours of financial difficulties. It's not even enough that it's in the press that this company is completely gone and there's no way and it's entering into administration tomorrow. If you terminate at that point, that's risky. That's jumping the gun. And it can be taken as a repudiatory breach. And you can find yourself on the hook for a lot of courts. So that's the danger there. You will usually have an express right to terminate, but make sure precisely when it's triggered. What the second big bullet point there is another SEGA point. Now, Section 14 of SEGA introduces a new rule in the Insolvency Act. And effectively, there are two rules here that apply in broadly the same way. First, the first rule is that a provision that would otherwise terminate a contract or give the supplier a right to terminate as a result of an insolvency process, such a provision is going to cease to have an effect. So what that means is that a customer, which in these cases includes an employer on a building project or a main contractor, when a customer enters into an insolvency procedure, the supplier, i.e. the person down the chain, can't terminate, or even if there is an express provision to that effect. The second rule in the new section 233B of the Insolvency Act introduced by SEGA, the second rule is that a provision that provides for any other thing to take place as a result of a customer being in an insolvent process ceases to have an effect. Now, what does any other thing refer to? Well, it's very broad, of course, but that's targeted at provisions that it's targeted at a situation where a supplier or a contractor wants to make continued supply of goods or services conditional on payment. So you get an insolvency situation and the contractor says, well, I want to be paid this amount that I've done before I do any more. And he has a clause in the contract that allows him to do that. And it's a very reasonable clause to have. However, that is now disapplied by SEGA and that can't work. So effectively, when an employer in this context becomes insolvent, a contractor, because of SEGA, can either terminate for insolvency or make continuing work subject to being paid outstanding sums. So that's quite a significant change to the law there. There are, of course, a couple of exceptions, very limited cases where termination can occur. Firstly, there are temporary exclusions from the prohibition on termination. These benefit small suppliers. And small suppliers are defined by reference to turnover under £10 million, balance sheet assets under £5 million, and employees under 50. So if your company qualifies for that, you needn't be too concerned about the new prohibition on termination. If you can't fit into that exclusion, if you're a larger company than that, then in order to terminate, you have two options. Firstly, you try to obtain the consent of the insolvent company or the insolvency practitioner. Failing that, it's time to make an application to court, and you can try and persuade a judge to grant permission to terminate on the basis that it would cause you considerable hardship. Now, I'm not aware of any concrete examples of that going to court yet. I don't know if you are, Andy, but as so far as I can tell, it's difficult to say how high that bar is.
Yeah, we aren't. And I don't. There's no definition of hardship. And obviously, the legislation has only been in force for 4 or 5 months now. So and during that time, we haven't really seen. Actually, the numbers of insolvencies have dropped off a bit because of the efforts the government has gone to protect businesses from going into insolvency processes during the pandemic. So I think it will be into next year before we start to see a larger wave of insolvencies occurring. And I think that's when we'll see how the market reacts to this new prohibition on termination for suppliers up the chain. The only thing I would add, Marcus, is the any other thing language is also, it's quite interesting in the context of what it means on suspension rather than termination, because there is a statutory right under the Housing Grants Construction Act that allows you to suspend in certain circumstances. And the any other thing language is actually referring to the provision of the contract itself, not other statutes. So it remains to be seen whether there's whether a supplier could in effect suspend rather than terminate under the Construction Act and get away with that, or use that as leverage to then do a deal with an insolvency practitioner. And I don't think, I mean, the SEGA was put together very quickly, partly as a response to the pandemic, and clearly in doing that, in putting the legislation together, they haven't had the time to cross off some of these ambiguities with other regimes, and that area of suspension is one where we don't really have an answer at the moment.
That's right, yes. And the other thing to note on that prohibition, of course, is it only applies one way. It doesn't prevent higher up the supply chain. So a developer, an employer, can still terminate for contractor insolvency in the normal way, and that may well happen. As you say, there's a certain amount of a ticking time bomb here of insolvencies that are being held off by the government's efforts to support this industry and others. But we may yet see next year that this all develops. On the next slide, still talking about termination, but now moving on to the consequences of termination. We're looking at what happens when you terminate and what rights you have there. Well, the relative clauses are set out on the slide there, and it's 8.7.2 in the design and build contract, and it's 91.1 in the NEC suite. Those generally entitle an employer in the case of termination to remove any temporary buildings, plant, tools, equipment. It requires the contractor to provide an employer with copies of design documents and so on. And crucially, the contractor can be required to assign to the employer, if requested, the benefit of any supply contracts for goods and materials. And that's very helpful. That assignment of contracts is very important, and it's a topical area, both for parties managing a transition and for disputes lawyers. I recently wrote a blog on the topic of assignment. It should be on the BCLP website by now. There's a case involving Hull Energy Works and MW High Tech projects. That was termination of a default rather than insolvency, but the lessons are the same. And what's difficult and what arises out of that case is the position of main contractors who are terminated and then required to assign their subcontracts to the employer and are then left sort of between two stools in terms of where their claims for delay and disruption arise. So that's a very problematic area for main contractors there, but it's rather beyond the scope of what we're talking about today. Another option on termination, which exists generally at law, of course, but is expressly confirmed in the standard forms, is that you can employ another contractor to complete the works of the insolvent contractor. That's clause 8.7.5 of the JCT, and it's also in the NEC. Now, you can, of course, claim the extra over cost from the insolvent contractor. Now, in many cases, of course, that's likely to be something of a mirage because the employer is going to rank as an unsecured creditor in that kind of circumstance and can recover pennies in the pound at best. And anyway, it's often difficult to substantiate additional costs until after the project is completed. So that is often not a very useful right, but it is interesting to know and valuable to know that it is there. And from there, of course, beyond that stage, there's a wide range for the terminating parties and a wide range of options and challenges relating to procurement of the remainder of the work. Does the employer want to engage a new main contractor, or does the employer want to get into contract management itself? Now, that's all part of the process of managing an insolvency situation and managing it through the project. If we move on to the next slide, the other range of options that we want to discuss on this talk was in relation to payment, of course. The simplest thing that a paying party wants to do, is to stop paying money into a black hole that won't do it any good on its project. And you need to check your contracts if that's allowed. Again, it's dealt with in the standard forms. JCT 8.7.3 says, on upon insolvency, no further sum becomes due to the contractor, and moreover, employer is not required to pay any sum that's already become due. provided it serves the proper notices. So in practice, that's very helpful. If an employer thinks that its losses from insolvency are going to exceed the amount of a payment application that's been made, the employer can then issue a pay less notice for zero or a nil amount. And that's a vital protection for employers in that kind of context, and prevents them from having to pay to an insolvent contractor when there'll be no way of getting any services or indeed the money back. Now, at this point, having stopped paying the main contractor in this circumstance, a lot of employers want to start exploring direct payment to subcontractors in order to keep them working. There may be a delay in the novation of subcontracts. They may just want to cut out the middleman and start to pay them directly. Now, in the past, the standard form contracts allowed for that, and they entitled the employer to deduct or recover those payments from the contractor. However, the current version of the standard forms don't include such wording, so it's worth looking at the contract drafting stage. And the main risk here, of course, is that direct payment to subcontractors creates a risk of double payment, because if the employer pays the contractor may still be entitled to payment for the work, and the administrator or liquidator may still come after you for that money. Now, there are two possible ways to avoid this risk of double payment. The first one is the one that you wish you'd done years ago when you were signing your contracts, is to foresee it in the contract. You create a direct payment regime in the contract. It usually has two things. Firstly, a clause allowing the employer to state in an interim certificate that a certain amount is due to a subcontractor and to make an equivalent deduction from the total to be paid to the main contractor. And secondly, an additional clause to clarify that the employment payment to the subcontractor extinguishes any claim that the contractor may have had against the employer for that sum. So it's dealt with in the notices, it's dealt with in the certificates, and so everybody knows that when a payment is made to the subcontractor, the main contractor won't have that claim. Now, there is a potential hitch there on which you will need advice. And sometimes an arrangement allowing an employer to deduct a direct payment may offend the insolvency rules as to pari passu distribution of assets. And that is complicated. There is a lot of case law on it. But potentially, if the contract is not drafted in the correct way and it does offend the insolvency rules, that can enable an insolvency practitioner to unwind that arrangement later on. The second solution to the direct payment problem, where you haven't foreseen it in your contract and you're dealing with it right now, is to create an indemnity system. Effectively, what you do is you pay the subcontractors, but you require your subcontractors to provide you with an indemnity to repay any monies if the contractor succeeds in obtaining payment for the same sums. And so what that approach does, it fixes the short-term need for cash and for the project to go on. But what it does in the long term is it reinstates the agreed position as to allocation of risk of the contractor not paying. And that is often used as a bargaining chip to obtain benefits from subcontractors in order to obtain improved collateral warranties or the like when they're restructuring these processes. So that's payment. Now, the last topic I wanted to talk to in any detail today was adjudication and insolvency. This is an area that's been moving on a lot this year, and I thought it would be useful to run through a few of the recent cases on this. And if we move on to the slide there, entitled Adjudication and Insolvency, the Post-Bresco World, there's a few bullet points on Bresco against Lonsdale. I'm sure I won't go through the background because I'm sure you're acquainted with the basic principles. There are very interesting decisions in the TCC and in the Court of Appeal, which are covered widely in the press. But the law is now stated by the Supreme Court in 2019, where the Supreme Court holds that not only does an adjudicator have jurisdiction to hear a claim by an insolvent party, but also that the insolvency regime and the adjudication regime are compatible, and so a claim should be permitted to proceed. That's the effect in principle, and it is a decision of principle because it has very little in the way of guidance as to how this is to work in practice. Because as to enforcement, of an adjudication decision, Supreme Court said the proper answer to issues about enforcement is to deal with those at the enforcement stage. So that's back to the TCC to assess what we do. So we may have this adjudication and then you go to court to try and enforce it, and then what's going to happen? Of course, that has led to a small flurry of cases about enforcement. And we've cited three on the slide. The first is Meadowside Building against 12 to 18 Hill Street. And that's a judgment of Adam Constable QC. And he commented on the concerns of the court there, commented on the concerns of the court relating to the utility of an adjudication, the preservation of the paying party's right to security for a cross-claim, and the reduction or elimination of cost risk. And those, so those are the concerns that we're looking at here. And effectively, what the judge there was looking for was a circumstance where satisfactory security could be provided, both as to the claimed sum and in respect of the adverse costs, to prevent the scenario where an insolvent party brings an adjudication, it's temporarily binding, the paying party has to pay it all, but then the paying party can't effectively go to final resolution in litigation and arbitration because there's no money. So that position needs to be protected. The second case we list there is John Doyle against Erith. That's probably now the most helpful guidance to how to approach these cases. That's a judgment of Mr. Justice Fraser in the TCC. And the judge there set down five principles to be applied whenever an insolvency party is trying to enforce. And those five principles are whether dispute is in respect of the whole of the party's dealings under the contract, whether mutual dealings exist outside the construction contract, whether there were other defences available to the defendant which were not deployed in the adjudication, whether the liquidator is prepared to offer undertakings to ring-fence the proceeds or provide other security, and finally, whether there's a real risk that summary enforcement of the adjudication decision will deprive the paying party of security for its cross-claim. So a whole list of really quite demanding criteria there to look at before a court is going to be satisfied that it can enforce an adjudication decision obtained by an insolvent party. One would tend to think that that will lead to very rare cases, and indeed that there are really not very many cases coming through, although whether that is due to the current almost sort of protected situation that the government has protected so much of the industry, we don't see the cases yet, or whether it's that those principles are being worked out behind the scenes, we don't know. But parties are succeeding in persuading judges to enforce in the right cases. I've cited one there, Stiles and Wood against the GECIF trustees. That's a TCC case from September. And effectively, it just boiled down to an argument about how much money the administrator there was going to put up as security and in what form. GE wanted him to put up 800,000, and the judge thought about the likely costs of the future litigation, worked through what the costs were likely to be, and decided that an AT insurance policy in about £200,000 was enough, provided that there was also ring fencing of the principal sum enforced. So where have we got to since Bresco? Well, effectively, where we've got to is one can't injunct an insolvent party from bringing a claim. It can proceed, but it is going to be very necessary for the insolvent party or their insolvency practitioners to put together a package of security when it comes to enforcement. Andy, we discussed this earlier today, and I think your perspective on that was the same, that it's actually going to be relatively unattractive, I think, for a lot of IPs to go through all that.
I think it is, Marcus. And I think what you said is absolutely right in terms of where there was success in the Stiles and Wood case compared with the other two that you've mentioned, Meadowside and John Doyle. It boiled down to, one, the approach of the office holder. So the insolvency practitioner, you must remember, they're both regulated as office holders, but they're also officers of the courts, and the courts will generally place considerable weight on the approach and opinion of an insolvency practitioner. So the distinction between giving express undertakings on their behalf personally and not, I think, is very important in the context of a court saying yes or no as to whether or not the enforcement should be allowed to proceed. I also think that there is a high bar that's been set in terms of the quality and the value of ATE cover and third-party security that needs to be procured here in order for the court to allow the enforcement to proceed. And as you say, from the point of view of the insolvency practitioner, that's not going to be straightforward, and it may be expensive to procure at the outset. So I think they're only going to do that in cases where they have a particularly valuable claim and a claim that they really think they're going to succeed on. Because what we have seen is if you turn up at the enforcement stage with a half-baked security package, then the courts will show you quite short shrift, and you're not going to be able to proceed.
Yeah, well, I agree.
So I think that's back on to me. Moving on to the final section of today's session, looking at retention of title issues that come up on construction projects where there is an insolvency. And I'd like to start off on slide 17, just with a very brief recap on the basics around retention of title, because this is often overlooked when parties get into arguments about ownership of goods and equipment that may be stored on one site or another. Now, fundamentally, you've got to always go back to the contract position first to make sure that there is a properly incorporated retention of title clause into the contract. That's the contract that the parties have been operating under, and to understand the scope of that clause and how it then links onto the goods and materials in question. Is the ROT clause a simple clause that requires payment of a specified invoice for title to pass, or is it an all monies clause in the sense that any outstanding invoice, whether it relates to those goods in question or not, has to be paid in full before title passes from the paying party to the supplying party. Once you've got to that position, if you think there is a retention of title, a valid retention of title clause one way or another, depending on which side of the fence you're on, it's only then that you move forward into assessing the status and the identity of the goods and materials in question. And if we move on to the next slide, which looks at some of the risks around this, I think it's worth saying that this will come up in my experience in two scenarios, either where you are the employing party and it's your contractor that's gone bust, and within your specified contract there are retention of title provisions, and you're arguing with goods in relation to goods and equipment under that contract. Or it may be that you are the employing party, it's your contractor in the middle that's gone bust, but it's the suppliers or subcontractors down the supply chain who actually are asserting retention of title claims. They don't have privity of contract with you, but you may be on notice of an ROT claim that they have under their supply contract with your insolvent contractor. And that can be equally as valid and is something that you need to be aware of if you are on notice of it. But being on notice of it is key from that perspective. Clearly, if you're not on notice of an ROT claim in relation to goods and equipment that have been supplied by someone who you don't have a direct contract with, then it's going to be much more difficult for them to assert ROT claims in relation to those goods and materials against you. Even if you are, there are certain defences that you can use, which often come up in construction cases, and I'll look at some of those briefly now. Now, fundamentally, if you're the party looking to assert the ROT claim, if you're reviewing the clause in a contract, what it'll often say is the goods should be segregated, roped off, or marked in a certain way, stamped, you know, some way of identifying clearly what those goods are and the fact that they belong to you as the supplying party, so that in circumstances where you do have a valid retention of title claim, you can go onto the site where they are stored and clearly identify those bricks are my bricks rather than another supplier's bricks, which may be next to it on a different pallet on the same building site. Now, there are risks if you haven't done that, and using bricks as the example again. Clearly, if you've got one pallet of bricks next to another pallet of bricks, they're unmarked and they're identical, then it's going to be very difficult for you as a supplying party to properly identify the goods. And if you can't identify them so as to reclaim them, then chances are you're going to lose your retention of title claim in those circumstances. Similarly, if the goods or materials in question change in nature from the after you've supplied them, then you can also lose identity and the ability to assert title to them. An example I always use there is the mixing of products. So there was a famous case some years ago that talked about resin and the loss of identity in a resin after it's applied to materials. So once it's put on wood as part of a project, the resin seeps into the wood. It's no longer distinguishable from it. It becomes part of something else. That's something else you don't have title over, and therefore your retention of title claim, even if it's valid under the contract, can be lost in those circumstances. If there is a valid retention of title claim, and the employer is on notice of that, or the contractor, whoever it is on notice of that and deals with the goods in ignorance of that retention of title claim, then there is a risk for a claim for damages or for the proceeds of sale of those goods and materials under the tort of conversion, which is essentially where you're dealing with another person's property. You can't do that without then accounting back to them for the losses they suffer as a result of you doing that. So if you are on notice of a valid ROT claim, you can't simply ignore it. If the supplier can successfully assert that against you, then there are potential damages claims that can be levied. All I would say on that for the purposes of this presentation is there is a considerable amount of case law out there on retention of title claims, specifically in relation to the construction sector. And each case generally tends to turn on the specific facts and circumstances of each one. But it's definitely something you need to be aware of. Moving on to the next slide, just some specific construction issues here before we finish on retention of title. So I mentioned earlier about the loss of identity of goods and how that can defeat a retention of title claim. Another way of doing that is if you have materials that become fixed or annexed to land, then they will also lose their identity and the retention of title claim will likely be defeated. If we go back to the bricks example that I was referring to earlier, if the bricks are no longer on the pallet, but they have been incorporated into a building so that they've become fabric of that building, and the only way to remove them would be to damage it, then chances are you will have lost your retention of title claim if you're looking to assert it on that basis. And if you're the party seeking to defeat it, then that's something that you can use in the opposite direction if that's what's happened. The key there, looking at that test, is really the level and the degree of the annexation involved. Again, there was a case a few years back that looked at air conditioning units in office buildings. And the supplying party successfully asserted that you can easily and quickly remove air conditioning units from the kind of inner roofing of an office building and from the piping work that goes alongside that without damaging the fabric of the land, even though they had been incorporated. So on that basis, it was successful in asserting its retention of title claim. But as I say, in relation to something like bricks, where it's much more difficult and you'd have to smash them up to take them out, chances are that wouldn't be successful. It's always important to remember that the burden of proof here in relation to ROT claims rests with the supplier. And that can be quite helpful if you're not the supplier. But if you are the supplier, then the key thing is to you need to act quickly. You need to get your ducks in the row in terms of your contractual rights. And you need to put the party that's holding those goods on notice expressly and specifically as quickly as possible of your ROT claim to avoid something happening with those goods that would then otherwise defeat your claim. And then finally, if you are the employing party at the top of the chain, there is a quite handy statutory defence available to you under the Sale of Goods Act. Section 25 of the Sale of Goods Act provides that where goods or materials are provided under a contract for the sale of goods only, so not the supply of services, but the sale of goods only, and the relevant contract there is the contract for the supply of those goods. So if it's a supplier further down the chain, it's their contract with their buying party. Even if the goods end up with you further up the chain as the employer, the relevant contract is the contract for the sale of those goods. Assuming it is a sale of goods contract, if you as the employer up here have already paid for those goods under your contract with the main contractor, And you've done that in good faith as a valid disposition under your main contract without notice of the retention of title claim, then even if there is a valid ROT claim further down the chain and there are no other defences available in terms of the treatment of those goods and materials, you as the employer can still defeat that claim by relying on Section 25 of the Sale of Goods Act. And that is something that we often use if we're advising employers on these types of claims, assuming they're not on notice of the ROT claim at the point of which they pay for them. And that's the key point there. So that's is a whistle-stop tour, if you like, from Marcus and myself on construction insolvency issues. There's a lot that comes up in this area and a lot to grapple with. Hopefully that's given you a useful legal and practical overview of the types of issues that you're likely to encounter, some of the key points to consider, and some of your options, legal and practical, that you can take in those circumstances to best protect yourselves or your clients' businesses. Thanks very much for listening, and have a good day.